Welcome to the Yoga Hour, offering insights and practices for spiritually conscious living in today's world. Here is your host, Dr. Laurel Trujillo.
Welcome to the Yoga Hour, where we talk about yoga in all its breadth and depth as a path to spiritually conscious, fulfilled living in today's world. I'm Dr. Laurel Trujillo, host and producer of the show. Today, we're going to be talking about recovery. Recovery from addiction, recovery from any habits that any of us have. Yoga, of course, has a lot of teachings about this, calls them samskaras, these patterns of behavior that we have. And yoga has so many tools to support us in recovering from these, and also providing inspiration and practical tools to help us cultivate a powerful and purposeful life and create a new design for living. I'm really fortunate to be joined today by Brian Hyman. Brian is a yoga instructor, meditation guide, Dharma teacher, author, and father. He has been clean and sober since 2009, and he has been teaching yoga and meditation at Cliffside Malibu since 2012. His dedicated work in the field of addiction treatment and recovery combines yogic philosophy, Buddhist wisdom, 12-step principles, and timeless insights from various spiritual traditions. His innovative teachings about healing and transformation have been featured in Whole Life Times, Mantra Wellness Plus Health, Yoga Digest, Sobriety Core, and many other publications and podcasts. Brian Hyman is the author of the book we'll be discussing today, Recovery with Yoga: Supportive Practices for Transcending Addiction. Welcome to the Yoga Hour, Brian Hyman. I'm really delighted you could join me today on the podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So before we dive into our dialogue about addiction and yoga's tools for recovery, let's begin with a moment of being right here, right now, a yoga moment. Om. So let's begin by just feeling our body in space. Whatever we're doing, just feeling our body, and in particular, feeling the surfaces that support our weight. Where are our feet? Now let's turn our attention to the breath and just notice the next breath. Just notice the inhale and exhale. On the inhale, what parts of our body are moving? And on the exhale, notice how that change returns to the resting position. The next inhale, feel the cool air in the nostrils. And on the exhale, feel that how that air has been warmed as it passes out through the nose. As we rest here, right where we are, here's a quote from Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien. Instead of asking for things to be different, when facing difficulty, pray to know what is true. Ask to see clearly the way things are. Then it becomes possible to choose to cooperate with the highest good. Instead of asking for things to be different when facing difficulty, pray to know what is true. Ask to see clearly the way things are. Then it becomes possible to choose to cooperate with the highest good. Om. Once again, Brian Hyman, welcome to the Yoga Hour. As I mentioned, I'm really delighted to have you here today to talk about your book, Recovery with Yoga, and to discuss the deep philosophical teachings of yoga and how they can support addiction recovery and actually support us all on our spiritual path of growth and transformation. I wanted to congratulate you on your 14 years of continuous sobriety. You mention in the introduction to your book that after 2 months of sobriety, you began to practice yoga every day as part of your personal program of action for recovery. So let's start right there. How did you find yoga, or what was it about yoga that you thought would be helpful in your recovery?
I believe yoga found me. I didn't really go looking for yoga. I wasn't looking for a new class to take at the gym or a new spiritual discipline. Yoga was something that was offered at a gym many years ago in New York City in the basement of the building where I was living. And I just happened to take the class by accident. And even then, something about the class was really special. It was physical movements I wasn't used to. It was I was invited to focus on things I wasn't used to focusing on, like breath or mindful movement and the space around me or my feelings, my heartbeat, the third eye center between the eyebrows, all these new interesting things. And it was different. It was at this time I was still actively drinking, so I wasn't sober yet. So at that point, it was this class at the gym, but it still found me. It's neat because the teachings of yoga can pierce through the false self, the addict mind, the whatever we want to call it, the devil, the darkness. The teachings, they got through the first time I practiced. I wasn't ready to listen or to study or to let them in. It was almost like something beautiful came to me and I said, not now, maybe later. I don't need you right now. I see you. I hear you, but I'm busy doing my thing. Leave me alone. And so fast forward, I would practice yoga here and there throughout the years, but it wasn't until, as you mentioned, a couple of months into my sobriety, I got back to a yoga class at the local gym here near Los Angeles where I live, and it really became special. So what happened was the yoga mat for me became a place of therapy. It became a sacred space, a safe place for me to process feelings and emotions, stuff I didn't know I needed to process or even think about, but stuff started to come out of me. Not so much physically, although I was sweating quite a bit during that early detox phase, but things started coming from me. It was things like memories and old ideas and thoughts and like you mentioned, samskaras, just old patterns and habits and conditioned ways of thinking, limiting beliefs. This stuff started to bubble up throughout my practice, and I would be on my mat and I would be with these things. Anger would come up, impatience would come up, and I had nowhere to run, nowhere to go. That's one of the blessings and one of the curses of practicing yoga is once you get on the mat, it's almost like getting into an airplane. Once they close those cabin doors, you're not going anywhere. Unless something catastrophic happens, you're sort of in for the ride. Mm-hmm. When you get into a yoga practice, when you get on your mat, I feel it's the same thing. You go for the ride. You take the ride. You put your seatbelt on. You put your tray in the upright position, and you get ready to take the journey. And that's what happened. I started to find some peace and I started to find some calm, and this is why I kept practicing. Even though some stuff came up that I really didn't want to think about or process or heal or transform, it was worth that temporary bit of discomfort to get to the lasting phase of freedom and liberation and almost a form of enlightenment that I was finding. Literally light was starting to come into my life by practicing yoga, and it was integral. I wouldn't just say it was part of my early recovery. I don't know if I would be sober or would have the life I have today had not yoga been a huge part of that early phase and still today, 14 years later.
I really like this quote that you wrote in the introduction to your book. The job of any teacher, this is from page 2, the job of any teacher, mentor, sponsor, or therapist who works in recovery is to point you home to your innermost self. All the answers you need are within you. Peace is there. Calm is there. Joy is there. Wisdom is there. Love is there. Recovery is there. This has always been and will always be true. I just love that. And to me, this quote really describes the essence of yoga. And so it made it really easy for me to see the connection, you know, between recovery and yoga. I wanted to ask you, what led you to write this book at this time?
This book actually started as an audio course I recorded for Insight Timer, a meditation app. And part of the course curriculum is there is an interactive course classroom available for students of all the courses on Insight Timer. And once the course was active, it was live, and people, students around the world were taking this course along with all the other courses on the app. They would ask questions. Certain questions would come in, and I would answer to the best of my ability. And what I started to realize was I would offer something in these course classrooms. And then another question would come in and I'd offer something more. Another question would come in, or a comment would come in, or a student would share their personal insight or reflection about a lesson. And I would continue to share. What I was doing without knowing it, now I know with some reflection, was the original course was based on 10 to 15 minute audio lessons that I had spoken into a recorder, and those were uploaded. That was the course. The interactive classroom became, that was the yoga. It was students offering their feedback. It was them offering their insights. And then it gave me a chance to look a little deeper at the original teachings and add things to them. And it became this sort of back and forth. And it wasn't long before a few of the students said, "You should turn this into a book. This would be great. Yeah. All these teachings, this would be great to hold in my hands and share with people and bring with me on the bus or the airplane." And so it was never an idea of mine to write a book based on this. It was just something that organically started to unfold, and it was collective. I can't take credit for it, because unless those questions came in, the original lessons would have stayed just those original teachings. Mm-hmm. But because I had open myself up to this opportunity to take questions, it's just a beautiful thing, because people would share about their personal recovery and how certain ideas that they came across in these course lessons would talk to them in a certain way and would help them, or would force them to stop and look at something. And then we got to go back and forth quite a few times, and it was just the natural next organic thing, just to go ahead and take that suggestion. And one day I just put together a book proposal, and I just used the same 30 lessons, and those became the 30 chapters. And then writing the book just became, again, more of a deepening of the original ideas and going a little deeper into the philosophy, and then taking it off the app and then onto the page, because it's a lot different. So speaking, you know, this is a podcast. So if someone can actually be sitting in their car right now listening to this, and they don't have to read a book or read. So it's a different way of sharing a message. So recording those lessons for the course, I didn't have scripts. I just had some basic ideas. Then I just started to speak. It was very conversational. Writing a book was very different. I actually sat down, and I really took almost 2 years and wrote near, you know, 5 days a week. It became a discipline. It became a yoga of itself. And so that gave me a whole nother chance to go even deeper. And I'm guessing maybe, you know, somewhere along the lines, I'll look back at this book and add some new things in some other way.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, the book is broken into 30 chapters. And in each chapter, you talk about a concept, giving a lot of background about from a yoga philosophy standpoint, et cetera. And just, you know, to read just the first several, give listeners an idea of, you know, what these little chapters are. So you start out with honesty, acceptance, surrender, courage, vulnerability, open-mindedness. I'm not going to read all, you know, 30, but just to give listeners an idea of, this is like really big, you know, sweeping ideas, and then talking about them both from a yoga standpoint and from a recovery standpoint. I think all of the concepts that you explore in the book are relevant to each of us, whether we're working to overcome addiction or just trying to understand ourselves and live more thoughtfully in the world. We did pull out several of those that I am going to, you know, ask you more about. The first chapter is about honesty, and you have this short quote from the Buddha: three things can't remain hidden long, the sun, the moon, and the truth. Which is a very lovely quote. And you also write, when someone who has a problem with alcohol, drugs, or other substances or similar issues and behaviors, when they can be truly honest with themselves, recovery is inevitable. And I was very struck with that. If, you know, if someone has a problem, if they can be truly honest with themselves, recovery is inevitable. That's a very powerful statement. So why did you start there? Why did you make honesty the first concept to bring forward in the book?
Without honesty, someone who has an issue, whether it's an addiction, alcohol, drugs, or some sort of negative or unwholesome behavior, without getting really honest, you know, that look in the mirror type of moment, that look within your soul type of moment, there's nowhere to go. We have to start at that place. So those 30 principles, they were ordered specifically. Honesty was first for a specific reason. Without honesty, we can't go into the remaining 29 principles, which are all timeless, eternal ideals, moral codes. They're universal. And that was intentional as well. So whoever picks up the book, you don't have to be a yogi. You don't have to be in recovery to understand things like honesty. Honesty is honesty. Honesty has a resonance to it. Most of us can tell when someone we know is lying. Their voice goes up. Their body gets weird. They start kind of they have trouble talking. Honesty is pretty universally identifiable. There's a resonance to it. There's a tone, a timbre to it. When someone speaks their truth from their heart, it's like watching an Olympic athlete do their thing. It's like watching a ballet dancer do their thing. It's like watching a concert pianist at the top level of their game doing their thing. There's such a sound. There's such a it's an audible, it's a visceral, it's a palpable thing. That's honesty. That's an artist when they're doing their thing. So for those of us in recovery, without getting to a place, and we don't have to do it beautifully. Most of us do it pretty, it's a pretty sloppy process. You know, you can imagine when someone has a problem with alcohol and, you know, are you an alcoholic? Yeah, kind of, sort of, I don't know. And if that's your level of honesty, that's actually a great start. It doesn't have to be, oh yes, sir, you're correct. Or I'm definitely an alcoholic, because for a lot of us, so honesty is not perfect. No one has to do that perfectly. It's just the willingness to open those closet doors, to pull the covers on something that's been hiding for a while.
Such a great description. I really appreciate the way in the book that you bring in ancient yogic teachings, and you also share Sanskrit words throughout the book. For example, you share the Sanskrit word satya, and it's you write about satya, or truth. It's offered as the moral code of honesty by which we can rightly navigate our lives. The Sanskrit root word sat means truth. Satya is how we're honest in the world. It is how we abide in an authentic place of neutrality. It reveals our communal, timeless, undeniable reality. It constitutes the essence of our innermost being. It is the force by which fluctuations within the mind are calmed, physical reactions become embodied, and spiritual objectives reach maturation. Just beautifully written about this satya, about this idea, this practice of truthfulness. So I loved the statements about satya as revealing our communal, timeless, undeniable reality. And also, I liked how you wrote about satya as constituting the essence of our innermost being. It's just really beautifully written. Would you share more about satya and your description of satya as, and this is a quote, about how we abide in an authentic place of neutrality in the world?
What stood out to me about satya when I learned that idea, it was somewhere early in my yoga practice. I had a lot of great teachers that would share, as you mentioned, they would share Sanskrit, they would share yogic principles and ideas and philosophy throughout the class. They'd tell us where to put our hands and feet and how to breathe and would lead us through the sequences. But then certain teachers would share something like Satya. And I don't know if I was, it's just because I was a little book nerd. I was a nerdy little kid when I grew up, so I got straight A's, and so that part of me was awake, listening. Like, that sounds interesting. I like that idea. I really, it really spoke to me, this other language, the Sanskrit, and these ancient concepts, which were actually pretty contemporary, pretty relevant. They were very accessible. Truth is truth, but I love they were calling it Satya. So I would dig into that on my own after class. And I loved with Satya, it wasn't just honesty, but it was authenticity. It's a way that we think, a way we speak, a way we move through the world. It's how we hold ourselves. It's how we interact with others. And it's a way, like you had mentioned, it's we abide, the, it's how we live, it's how we dwell from a place of honesty. And again, like we talked about, when someone's lying or being dishonest, they're keeping secrets. They're shrouded in some sort of it's a darkness. It's an energetic force field they put around themselves, or we. I'm not excluded from that. There are times where I'm not completely 100% totally honest, and I can feel it. And that's not how I want to live because I've lived that way. That's what happens for a lot of us in active addiction. We're living a lie, and it makes us feel horrible. It's killing us from the inside. So abiding in a truthful place, you're actually living from a place of ease and freedom and light. It's a much easier, softer way to live. It's the path of recovery. So to live in that place, it's really interesting because you don't have to have a script. You don't have to have notes in front of you. It helps if you need to do that for a project or something, but when you're living your truth and speaking your truth, that's all that matters. It's a beautiful thing. Someone asked me years ago when I started teaching yoga, like, do you know what you're going to say? How did you know you're going to say that thing or that thing about Satya you were teaching? Where'd that come from? And I'll share, I have no idea. Before I teach a class, I ask God to speak through me. I ask to be useful in this situation. So I don't try to make any of this happen. I'm just trying to be truthful and go to that place of Satya where I can really be authentic. So whatever's supposed to come out will come out. Whatever you're supposed to hear, you'll hear. Whatever the next person's supposed to hear, they'll hear. But that won't happen unless I'm actually doing my personal inner work, which is clearing out all the secrets, all the dishonesty, all the untruths, getting all that stuff out. It's a continual process. And just making myself a clean, pure channel that I so I can be useful in the world.
Again, what you were just describing, about not having honest, not honesty, not having to be perfect, from the beginning. For those who are beginning the practice of yoga, you start with the yamas and the niyamas, and the yamas are ethical principles that we live. And one of them is this satya that we've been talking about. And the way I find my own practice is you start out being honest about the things that you can see. And then you realize that there's a lot other places to be honest that you didn't, that it didn't even occur. They didn't even occur to you at the beginning. And so in a way you can't be like 100% honest at the beginning because you can't even see it, at the beginning. But the more that you practice, the more that it opens, for you. And sometimes at the beginning that can be really hard because you start to see a lot, that maybe you don't, you don't, it doesn't look so great, the way you've been living, and sometimes that can be really painful. The next concept I want to explore is surrender. You write that in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the concept of Ishvara Pranidhana is presented as one of the five self-disciplines or niyamas. Ishvara can be translated as God. It can also be viewed as supreme consciousness, the divine source, or absolute reality. Pranidhan is to surrender, devote, or fix our gaze upon. Ishvara Pranidhan is recognized as self-surrender to God, to humanity, or to a greater good. It's a really lovely description of this practice of self-surrender. And I wanted to ask, why do you think surrender is so important in recovery?
Surrender invites humility. In this book, surrender comes right after acceptance, which comes right after honesty. So after we get honest to our our best ability, as you mentioned. And I agree that we can only be as honest as we can be today. And then maybe next year we'll be a little more honest about some things that have revealed themselves to us. And then we accept what comes up through this process. Surrender would be next. And surrender is really important because it does invite humility. Once we get really honest about whatever might be going on in our lives and we come to accept that, surrender will be the next natural thing, which is in this case, for example, I have a drinking problem. I have to get honest about that. If I can accept that, that invites me to surrender. Now I need to find the solution. So that invites the humility, which allows me to ask for help, where I'll get solutions, I'll get suggestions, I'll find community, whatever the next thing might be. Without surrendering, I'm still stuck in ego and pride, thinking I can do it myself, which is a really dangerous place to be. If I can't surrender this thing, let's say I have cancer, and all of a sudden I think I can beat this on my own. I don't need doctors or chemo or radiation or surgery. I might die. That's a very dangerous attitude. It's a very, it's egoic. It is very prideful, and it's not healthy for a lot of us to think that we can do everything all by ourselves. There are lots of things we can do on our own, but in regard to the book, in regard to recovery, I haven't seen many people get sober on their own unless they make this surrender, this ultimate surrender. And again, this can be piecemeal. This can be in different stations or stages as well. There's only so much we can surrender early on. So maybe it's something like, I think I have a problem with drinking, but I maybe not the drugs. And then we get a little more honest. We realize, yeah, actually, I have a problem with both. And then I think I also have a problem with, and the more we surrender, the more we let go of, and the more we become clean, we become clear, like a blank canvas. Then we can actually do something with adding new things or finding things that were always there underneath those addictions and those habits that were just waiting to come out. But without the surrender, we're still in trouble. We still have this bravado or this machismo, as they used to say when I grew up. I used to hear that, like, I think you're so cool, you think you're too strong, and that's not a great attitude in recovery. So
So you write about this first of the Yoga Sutras. My teacher and the founder and spiritual director of this podcast, Ellen Grace O'Brien, often highlights this first sutra of the Yoga Sutras, Atta Yoga Nushasanam, which is translated to mean now yoga begins. And what I always think is so funny, and as she points out, there's only 196 Yoga Sutras. So, like, why? It's the first one. Like, why would they bother to say it? Well, they say it because it's important, you know, this idea of now. So, in the chapter on presence, the chapter on presence, and you share the sutra, you write the first word of the sutra, atta, or now, signifies how essential present moment awareness is if spiritual aspirants are to evolve along a yogic path. The use of the word atta is intentional and indispensable. It commands our attention. It leaves no room for misinterpretation as it elucidates the eternal truth that now is the only moment wherein we learn, grow, and transform our lives. Would you share more about how the concept of being in the present moment is particularly important for people struggling with addiction?
we can't get sober yesterday. That just doesn't make sense. Yesterday's gone. And we can't get sober tomorrow. Tomorrow's not here. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But what we do have is today. We have today. We have the now. This is the only time that we have to heal, to grow, to love, to live is now. I think it's huge. I think I might have heard someone, a friend in recovery, mentioned Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, when I first got sober. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good book title. I'll go to the library and I'll check that out. And I started reading it, and it was when the saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. That's what happened. I was ready to learn about being present. I didn't know how ready I was until I started reading that book, and I realized how not present I had been. most of my life up until that time when I first got sober. Either we're stuck in the past or thinking about regret, shame, remorse, guilt, or we're jumping into the future and there's anticipation and worry and anxiety and fear. Rarely are we in the present moment. In the present moment, there's a lot of great stuff. It's a shame that we're not there long enough to experience it and enjoy it. There's love, there's peace, there's calm, there's balance. I don't know if there's balance yesterday. Yesterday's gone. I don't know if there's going to be peace tomorrow. Who knows? But I do know that I'm here now. So if I can work on that, I'm going to have a good shot, a good chance at living a pretty decent life, a pretty good life, pretty happy and healthy life if I can stay present. And then when I saw that as the first teaching in the Yoga Sutras, I thought that's what really stood out to me personally, in regard to starting this collection of teachings. Now yoga begins. Now the teachings of yoga. I thought, oh, that's just a great reminder. Like, hey, wake up, listen up. Now, come here. I'm talking to you now. Are you in the present moment? Because I got something to talk to you about. We're going to go through some things. You need to be here. Get your head out of the clouds. Stop thinking about the past. Let's get to it. Because unless you're there, you're not going to hear it. It's going to go right over your head and right, you're going to miss the whole thing.
Absolutely. That's so great. As a reminder to our listeners, today on the Yoga Hour, my guest is Brian Hyman. Today, we are discussing his book, Recovery with Yoga. You can find out more about Brian Hyman at his website, brianhymanyoga.com. Again, Brian, Brian Hyman, Hyman, yoga.com, brianhymanyoga.com. He's also on Facebook and Instagram at Brian Hyman Yoga. These links will be on our website at theyogahour.com. We welcome your comments and questions. You can contact us via that website, theyogahour.com, where you can also sign up for our mailing list. So, Brian, getting back to the book, you begin your chapter on meditation with the following. Meditation can be likened to a raft that brings us to the other shore of enlightenment. It bridges various states of consciousness within the reality of now to deliver us from fear to love, anger to calm, and stagnation to transformation. It is a personal journey that allows us to glimpse who and what we truly are through honest self-assessment of current mental formations. Just did a beautiful job of capturing meditation and the benefits of meditation. Would you share more about those benefits of meditation, particularly for people in recovery?
Meditation, it's so beneficial to so many types of people. So those in recovery, we don't need special meditations, which is beautiful. We don't need special books. We're human beings just like anyone else, which is one of the main reasons I do the work I do, is to really destigmatize addiction and mental health issues. This is a human thing, just like the principles. If all these 30 principles in the book are relatable, anything we're talking about, like meditation or recovery or love or surrender or acceptance, honesty, these are all relatable as well. So meditation is relatable, whether you're in recovery or not. However, that said, those who do suffer from active addictions, there are certain things that we have decided to ignore for many years. We've decided to push away or push down, whether physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And so meditation, for me personally, I can share that it's something that I didn't want to do when I first got sober, because my thought was, if I sit with myself, I don't know what's going to come up. I don't know what I'm going to think about. And I don't like the idea of that. I don't know if it's going to be something really creepy and weird and negative or scary, and so I just avoided it as long as I could until I had about 14 months sober, and I wasn't all that calm or peaceful, and I was trying to figure out why. I had my sobriety, I had worked the 12 steps, and things were going good, but something was off. And finally, someone, a friend in recovery, said I should try meditation. And I thought, oh geez, I don't want to do that. That's the
Not
last. Not
that.
that. It's the easiest thing, but it's the hardest thing to once you get to it, it's pretty simple, and I can't live without it today. But it's to get started. It's you're jumping into the unknown. It's like leaping off a cliff and hoping some wings will grow on the way down. And I sat for the first time, and the idea, back to your question, was what I was trying to do was quiet my mind. My mind was really busy, it was moving very fast, and I had a lot of thoughts, and I wasn't that present. I thought I was, but I wasn't. And meditation was the great equalizer. It was finally something. In addition to my physical yoga practice on the mat, meditation was an added bonus where I was invited to sit and just be with myself. And what happened was, yes, things did come up, memories, thoughts, ideas. But the beauty is, I was told just focus on your breath. So I was given an anchor, I was given a lifeline. No matter what, just keep focusing on your breath. And I did that. And I made it through those first few sessions. And then at some point, time disappeared, space disappeared, problems disappeared, the past and future disappeared. And I remember the first time I had set my alarm on my phone. And in the meditation, I just heard a weird noise and I wasn't sure what was going on. It was beautiful. It was like harps or chimes or something. And I thought, where am I, in heaven? This is just neat, because I had gone somewhere in my meditation. And then I started to come back to reality and I realized, oh, wait a second, that's actually the alarm on my phone. I didn't even recognize it. And that's when I realized the transcendent power of meditation. It literally took me somewhere else in my mind where I didn't even recognize my phone alarm. I thought it was like I was in heaven with some sort of beautiful music playing, and it was just incredible. So what meditation does for people in recovery, it's something like that. It'll quiet your mind in a way that other things may not. It'll give you a chance to find stillness and comfort in your own skin, in your own body. It'll, because most of us we're moving pretty fast. We're all over the place. We can't stay still. And this is not just people in recovery. This is most of us as human beings. We're just dropping things, stubbing our toes, cracking things, falling things, banging into things. We're moving pretty fast. So meditation is nowhere to go. You just sit there and you breathe and you get quiet. And what happens is, if you have things like cravings, they won't be as intense. If you feel things like fear, it won't be as intense. If you're anxious, that'll be subdued. If you're stressful, same thing. So meditation is a really great sort of one-stop shop for, again, not just for people in recovery, but just anyone who wants to work on quieting their mind and relaxing their body. And then the last piece for me was connecting to what I was starting to find was that spiritual piece, the spirit, the whether it's God or it's a higher power, whatever we choose to call it, it's an individual personal thing. I was starting to find that connection. And it's hard for me to find that when I'm active out in the world talking and running and doing things. But meditation, everything stops. And it's a really wonderful opportunity to meet your maker, as the saying goes, to come back to your creator, source, nature, the universe, that space within all of us where we really find that beautiful place where everything gets quiet. It should, hopefully.
That's a great description. One of the things I really appreciated about the chapter on meditation is you really include information about meditation techniques that are particularly relevant for those in recovery. And I hadn't looked at some of these things the way that you described them, and I thought it was actually really cool to look at them from that perspective. So, for example, you encourage readers to, quote, find a quiet and clean location. Kind of a standard meditation advice, quiet, clean location. But you further note that addiction thrives within chaos and clutter. You encourage readers, another section, to find a comfortable position and cultivate stillness. Again, very kind of standard, meditation instruction. But you also point out that, and this is a quote, addiction can hardly overtake a truly stable person. Thus, it targets and assails those who are unable to regularly remain mentally and bodily still. Another section, when you encourage readers to close your eyes, you point out that, and this is another quote, addiction does not wish for meditators to know that peace and harmony are eternally available in the present moment. So beautiful. Addiction does not wish for meditators to know that peace and harmony are eternally available in the present moment. Again, I found these reflections that you have, particularly about meditation and addiction, to be just really rich. I was really enjoying, reading that perspective and understanding that perspective a bit more. So would you share a bit more about these practical tips about how to meditate for those that are working on their recovery?
I view addiction as an entity, as an energy. It's almost like this dark force or dark cloud that, just like if someone were going to rob a house and they get to a neighborhood and they see three houses, if two houses have lights on and there's action, but there's one house that's dark, the windows are open, there's nobody home, the thief is going to attack the one house that is an easy target. They're going to not have much trouble getting into that one house. They're not going to bother with the ones that are fortified, that have an alarm system, that are protected, that are safe, that are clean, that have people who are present there. It's going to attack the one that is vacant. And that's what happens in active addiction. We become vacant, we become open, we become prey. We're susceptible to the onslaught, the attack of addiction. And one of the best ways is to fortify yourself. Put a wall around your house. Put the alarm system on. Meditation does that. It grounds us in the present moment. It helps us find a stability, solidity. Addiction's not going to bother with you. It'll move on to the next victim, whatever that may be. So one of the best things we can do is ground yourself. Fortify yourself, strengthen yourself in the present moment. The addiction will be like a dark cloud, it'll just pass over. But if we leave ourselves open, and we leave ourselves open by not staying present, by being active with in different behaviors that keep us vulnerable. It's a sad thing because I work in the field of treatment, and so I see, I've been doing it for 12 years now, and so I see people and they share their stories, and I've lived it as well, and I know the difference now because I'm also on the other side of it where I don't miss my meditations. I don't miss opportunities to keep myself strong and stable and fortified and protected. So I don't like when darkness comes to visit me, and I'm not going to leave a door open for it. So it's up to me to make sure that the door is closed and everything that I have inside is protected. I love my life now. I wouldn't let anything in my life be put in a position where it's going to be taken or stolen or damaged in any way. And that includes my mind, my thoughts, my everything.
So the last concept I wanted to focus on for our time today is compassion. In the book, you say, or you write, compassion in recovery begins with oneself, if it is to be authentic and effective, when its three foundational components of self-acceptance, self-forgiveness, and self-love are implemented within a program of action, a boundless capacity to empathize with others is forged in our consciousness. This state of inner disarmament can then express itself benevolently throughout our relations with all people, places, and things. So let's walk through those three things that you point to. Would you say more about the importance of self-acceptance?
Self-acceptance is something that allows us to really find contentment and peace in the present moment. Anytime we wish things are different, we're not going to be happy or at peace. When we're not in acceptance of things as they are, there's going to be suffering. So self-acceptance doesn't mean you have to like whatever is happening or condone behavior of others around you. It just means that you're willing to see the actuality of something. I accept this is how things are right now. If I don't have a job, or if if my health is poor, if I can accept that, I can move into a place where I can open myself up to a solution, an action to take. But if I'm in denial, I won't get there. So self-acceptance is, and why it's related to compassion is, I'm aware of my situation, whatever it might be. I accept myself for whoever I am today. I think this lays the ground, the foundation for moving into compassion. If I can't do this for myself, how am I going to do it for someone else? Compassion is to be with the suffering of someone else, essentially. It has to start with me, but it has to start with accepting my own conditions first. So if I don't have what I think I need today, can I accept that? If I can't, I can't look at you and help you accept where you are or have compassion for you. It has to start with me.
Which then leads to the second, factor that you talked about. So the three were self-acceptance, self-forgiveness, and self-love. So we've talked about self-acceptance. And in writing about self-forgiveness, you say, you write, when we remain unforgiving towards ourselves, our insecurities project outwardly and prevent us from intuiting the inmost essence of goodness within others. This is something, it's just so interesting to me. Sometimes if I listen to my own internal dialogue, and I imagine myself, if I would ever say something like that to like a friend of mine, and it's just like, we can be so hard on ourselves and tell ourselves things that we would never ever say to, for example, someone that we love. So would you say a bit more about the importance of self-forgiveness?
Right, just like you said, we can beat ourselves up all day long, and we can keep chewing over things in our minds, something we said we shouldn't have said, we said the wrong way, and it just and we're and it's eating us alive, and we're having a hard time being present or being available to others because we're not able to forgive ourselves. I've heard stories, I've seen people, I've read things where people hold shame, they hold guilt, they hold remorse, regret for years, decades. And these things can ruin your life. I'm not being over dramatic. These things can block you from one of the phrases I love that's in recovery is the sunlight of the spirit. Whatever has happened, the self-forgiveness is the first piece, because I can't forgive you for anything. If you call me a name and I haven't figured out how to stop myself from calling myself names, I'm not going to forgive you for calling me a name. So it starts with me. For example, if I don't like something in my life or something I did, I have to be willing to forgive myself, be gentle with myself. And if I can do that, it's going to make me more available to you. Again, in regard to compassion, it's self-compassion. It's I'm not going to rake myself over the coals for years over something I did. If I made a mistake, I atone for it. I make an amends. I apologize. This is part of the forgiveness process as well, is take some action along with it. But essentially, we will, like you talked about, we are going to. Yoga is a unification. It's to unify. We mirror each other. So, if I'm not going to forgive myself for anything, I'm going to have a really hard time forgiving anyone else for anything they do, and my outlook will become really bitter and really dark really quick. If I'm holding on to a bunch of stuff that I don't forgive within myself, I'm going to look at you with the same type of filter. I'm going to wonder why something going on with you, and I'm going to start to make up stories in my head as well, because that's what's going on in my head. But if I can clear it out of here, out of my head, out of my heart, I'm going to be able to look at you with no lens, just raw in a very natural, organic way. I'll see the real you instead of all these things that I'm projecting onto you because it's stuff that I haven't figured out or processed or healed within myself. So that self-forgiveness is huge, just to whether it's looking into the mirror, that's a practice that works for a lot of us, whether it's writing something in a journal, whether it's talking to a priest, a rabbi, or a spiritual friend, a mentor, a therapist, a sponsor. We talk about these things and we let these things go so we can really be compassionate.
We talked earlier in the show about the importance of now. And the other thing to me of anything that is, if you can't forgive yourself in a way, you're being trapped in the past. It's something that happened. You can't change it. You need to do something to be here now and to move forward. So the third component of compassion that you write about, in addition to the self-acceptance and the self-forgiveness, is self-love. So, would you say more about why self-love is so essential?
Self-love, the first thing I'm thinking about today is when we love something, we only want to treasure it. Ideally, we'd want to take care of it, nurture it, support it, treasure it. I have a daughter, she's 9 years old right now, and I would never feed her poison. I would never pour motor oil into her drinking glass. I would only give her things that would make her feel healthy and happy and supported and taken care of and loved. For those of us who have suffered from an addiction, once we realize that we've been hurting ourselves or poisoning ourselves, we have to look at that. That's not an act of love. When you know that drinking is hurting you, but you keep drinking for whatever reason, if you're doing drugs or if it's a sex behavior or if it's a food issue or whatever the addiction or behavior may be, once we start to realize again with that first principle of honesty, we get honest and we say, I don't think this is a good thing in my life anymore. It's really starting to ruin my relationships. It's making me feel like I don't want to feel. We start to realize the opposite of self-love is self-loathing. It's self-hatred. So if you love something, you want to take care of it. You want to treasure it. And this is a huge piece in recovery for a lot of people is to look at that. Why were you poisoning yourself? Why were you harming yourself? What was going on there? It's usually a pretty revolutionary moment. It's a transformative moment where we realize we have to take the trip from the island of self-hatred and make it over to the land of self-love. And no matter what, don't ever go back to that place. It's subtle, which is really strange. Some of us can look in the mirror and go, oh, I hate my hair today. Oh, I hate these wrinkles under my eyes. Oh, I hate my double chin. Whatever it might be, it starts subtle. It's the way we think, it's the way we speak, it's the way we act, and then it becomes a way of being. It's almost like this cloak, this shroud we wear over us, and it's not healthy. It's hard to be compassionate with others when you're not even compassionate to yourself. So self-love is huge. And this one can start with, I think the mantra that I offered in the book as a practice was Aham Prema, which is I am love. Even if you have to fake it, if you want to use English, if you want to use Sanskrit, even if you want to just write it down, just to start to train the mind in a different way. I am love. I am worthy of love. I deserve health. And we can act our way into self-love, which will definitely help us be more compassionate. It just makes sense. How can you care for someone else if you can't even care for yourself? At some point, something's going to break.
Well, you have written a really lovely and I think a very important book. I really appreciate the way you bring yoga philosophy into a system of daily practice that can support each of us, whether we're in recovery or not. Over your years of teaching and working with people who are struggling with addiction recovery, what have you seen as the difference between, for example, someone who is able to adapt some of these, teachings of yoga philosophy, and some who maybe are struggling more and aren't able to do it. What do you see that yoga really brings to recovery?
For those who are attracted to the teachings of yoga, I've seen no ceiling or no limit to how far they can go, how far they can take the teachings on their own, personalize them, individualize them, modernize them, make them really contemporary and relatable and accessible. I think that goes for anything, though. So I have a friend in recovery, and he's into martial arts. So his martial arts practice is like his yoga. Meaning he doesn't do a yoga class, but he does his martial arts. He doesn't read yoga philosophy, but he reads books on Zen and Tai Chi and Qigong. And that is, I've seen it personally, enhance his recovery thousandfold. So I think for whatever anyone wants to add to their recovery, in this case, yoga philosophy, my personal experience is What I used to tell friends early on was it supercharged my recovery. So I had my recovery based on the work I had done with the 12 steps, and I read Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, and a few other things here and there. And then once I added the yoga piece, it was like strapping a rocket to my back and I just took off. That was my journey personally, was I found it was such a richness, such a depth to the philosophy. One, because it goes back thousands of years. Two, because it's universal. You don't have to bow down to anything. It's not a religious thing. It's whatever you want to make of it. You can take this piece over here, leave that piece over there. You can customize your practice, especially in yoga. We have so many styles of physical practice. We have so many styles of breath work. We have so many ways of meditating. But I've seen that those who do adapt or take yogic teachings into the recovery, it's so beneficial. It's so beneficial.
Well, each of us is so different, and I love that. I love how there are so many paths, and certainly I think that the yoga path brings an awful lot, for people. And, it's not the right path for everyone. So thank you for, mentioning that. Actually, we recently, just a couple of weeks ago, had a yoga hour converse I had a yoga hour conversation with a Tai Chi master, and that was a really interesting one as well. Anyway, we have come to the end of our time today. In closing, what words of encouragement or inspiration would you like to share with our listeners?
I'm just
It's not like what you've said so far hasn't been inspirational or encouraging, so I should say that.
I pause because this overwhelming sense of gratitude just came over me that it wasn't like my life or my recovery flashed before me when you answered that, but I was sitting here and you asked this question if I had any words of encouragement. I just remembered where I came from, just briefly. And the fact that I'm sitting here talking with someone from the vantage point that I have now in recovery, with what I've been able to learn, the opportunities I've been given in recovery, I was speechless for a moment, just because for those who do hang in there, and I'll include myself in that category, that would be my suggestion. Just hang in there because you have no idea how good it can get. Before I got sober, I was miserable. I was sad. I was angry. I had suicidal thoughts. I wasn't in a good place mentally or emotionally or physically, or I didn't even know what the spiritual part was back then. And to be where I am sitting today, it's a miracle. And I'm not special or unique in any way. I'm not any smarter. I'm not any it's not about anything other than the willingness to just hang in there and just to do the next right thing. Long way to say, just hang in there, do the next right thing, ask for help if you need it, and don't be ashamed. If you have an issue with an addiction, you're one of millions of people in the world who have an issue with something. Even if the addiction is an addiction to, these days it could be social media, video games, it could be streaming things on the TV. So it's not even the alcohol or the drug thing anymore. Maybe the addiction is something completely more contemporary, social media addiction, electronic addictions are new. So wherever you are, whatever you need to work on, you're most likely not the only one, which is good news. There are people out there that can help you, that can relate to you, that can share their experience with you. So find some other people, hang in there, do the next thing, ask for help, find some other people, find some groups that might be able to help you, share their experience with you, and just don't give up. Just keep trying and keep moving forward.
Really great advice. Really great advice. For our listeners, you've been listening to the Yoga Hour. It's been my pleasure to share this time with you. I'm Dr. Laurel Trujillo, producer and host of the show. My guest today has been Brian Hyman. You can find out more about Brian Hyman, the book we've been discussing today, which is called Recovery with Yoga. You can find out about his online programs at Brian's website, brianhymanyoga.com. Again, Brian Hyman, Hyman, yoga.com. You can also follow him on Facebook and Instagram at Brian Hyman Yoga. Thank you so much, Brian Hyman, for joining me today on the show.
Thank you for having me.
For listeners, we hope you'll join us for the many online programs offered by the sponsor of this program, the Center for Spiritual Enlightenment. There is daily online meditation in the morning at 6:30 a.m. Pacific, in the afternoon at 4, and on Monday evenings at 7:30. Again, all those times are Pacific time. We also offer a Sunday satsang. Satsang is a Sanskrit word meaning a gathering of truth seekers, and that happens at 10 a.m. Pacific each week. Another podcast that might be of interest to listeners of this podcast is the Kriya Yoga Today podcast with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, and you can find that and more information about the Center for Spiritual Enlightenment, the many events and programs at csecenter.org. You can also find it wherever you get your podcasts. Join us next time on the Yoga Hour when my guest will be author Susie Amendola. We will be discussing how to stress less and improve your heart health. The Yoga Hour is a service project of the Center for Spiritual Enlightenment, a meditation center in the Kriya Yoga tradition. Remember, you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and if you're enjoying it, share it with a friend. Thank you to the Yoga Hour team, founder and spiritual director, Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, assistant producers Anne Hayes, Mickey Coronado, Christine Soate, and Lauren Leidinger. I look forward to being with you again. Until then, remember, you carry your own healing and wholeness within you. Share your peace and joy with all you meet. Bye now.